Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is May 7th. I am welcoming for the first time to the show Pam Lukashew. Pam is currently the legislative liaison for Teach CT, that is the Education of Christian Homeschoolers of Connecticut. She is going to be one of the presenters at a conference I am attending. It begins a month from today, and it is in Connecticut. It is called the Red Pill Expo. Runs June 7th through the 9th. It's going to feature speakers like G. Edward Griffin and Robert Kiyosaki. It is being organized by two of my dear friends, Lisa and Richard Grove. Have you heard of them? Of course you have. So I'm looking forward to getting out to Connecticut for that in about a month. We were looking through the list of speakers together recently. I found several people whose voices I wanted to add to our show. Pam is the very first speaker at the event. In the title of her presentation, Tracing the Education Fuse to the UN. This is a subject that we've definitely touched on before, but I thought it was worth revisiting. Obviously, we always have a lot of new people in the audience who have not gone back through our vast archives. But Pam's work extends well beyond just looking at how entities like UNESCO or policies like Agenda 21 might be impacting schooling in America and around the world. Her work in Connecticut includes partnerships with the Connecticut Parental Rights Coalition, formed to respond to the Sandy Hook Commission report. We're going to be talking about that in the show in some detail today, and how legislators made subsequent attempts to intrude into home education using the Sandy Hook massacre as a pretext. And let me talk about one of the reasons why I wanted to have Pam on the show. There is a multi-front battle on compulsory schooling. Part of that is the presentation of novel and exciting alternatives to how things have traditionally been done, right? Whether we're talking about the lower levels of school versus home education or college versus what we talked about in the last show with Isaac Morehouse. Exciting new educational alternatives can be very glamorous. And it often takes the spotlight away from people like Pam who are doing really valuable defensive work to stop further intrusions into the minds and the lives of children and the cohesion and privacy of families. And I really believe that that work needs to be spotlighted as well. And a question to ponder at the beginning of this conversation. We think about the United Nations impact on what children in America, as young as elementary school children, are being exposed to, and the reshaping of attitudes and values that those exposures often bring about. Once people accept the idea the education of children is a responsibility to be outsourced to bureaucrats, how far away can educational decision-making get from the individual, from the family, even from the community? And we're going to provide some uncomfortable answers to those questions today. So that's Pam Lukashew, a representative of a large collection of underappreciated defenders of parental rights and children's minds. And I'm happy to be able to give her a platform on School Sucks. One quick production note. Later on in the conversation, I mention quickly, and we don't dig into it in any substantive way, that the phrase lifelong education, or lifelong learning, I think, was coined by Vladimir Lenin. And if that piques anyone's curiosity, it is a reference to a decree, Lenin's decree, at the end of 1919. It was called On the Eradication of Illiteracy Among the Population of the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic, directing individuals between the ages of 8 and 50 years old. That sound young to you? It's basically lifelong in a communist state. To become literate. At this time, there were about 100 million illiterates in that age group in the Soviet Union. From a journal article in Comparative Education, Adult Education and Lifelong Learning, New Developments in Russia by Joseph Zajda. Education in the USSR between 1922 and 1991, including the vast Soviet project of adult education, which until recently focused on a partly imposed requirement of lifelong learning for working adults, included the more or less obligatory compensatory education, improvement of qualifications, and provision of opportunities for relearning. That's a phrase, huh? Now, obviously, and I'm not saying that this isn't part of this project, and some people might say about higher literacy rates in the Soviet Union, that's a good thing. Sorry, it's a bad Bernie Sanders impression. Yes, true. There are obviously economic and industrial benefits to higher literacy rates, and the Soviet Union realized many of those benefits in the decades that followed, immediate decades that followed, anyway. But think about North Korea for a minute. Everybody gets a little TV. And why? Why? Because the ills want you to be entertained? No, because the ills want you to be informed. Finger quotes informed. When Lenin issued this decree in 1919, television and radio did not exist. Reading was the only means. The written word was the North Korean television. But if you're very new, this is a, you know, you look at the history of the Soviet Union, this is kind of a training wheels example of how language can be used to mask some very ultimately unhelpful collectivistic kinds of agendas. Education, lifelong learning, lots of calls to set children free from their parents, but without giving them the requisite critical thinking skills to function in the world without guidance from somebody. But this is indeed a conspiracy, a plan made in secret. The documentation on this is deep. And the prime objective is the continued centralization and further exertion of control. So thanks again to Pam for being one of the people who are elucidating this. Final announcements before we get started. Right on the heels of this podcast is a new episode of The Discomfort Zone. Andrew and I, for the first time, welcomed a listener into the conversation. And we had what I thought was a wonderful 90-minute chat, a lot of it talking about relationship issues and difficulties with attitudes about food. If you want access to all episodes of The Discomfort Zone, please help us out by going to patreon.com/schoolsucks. You can also support the show, support our efforts, help us spread our message by going to schoolsucksproject.com/AV and becoming a member in our AV club. And thank you to everybody who does that. Your help is greatly appreciated, especially right now as we tackle some big novel projects around here. And that support is not only supportive in those endeavors, it is also very motivating. So thank you, everybody who does it. If you want more information about the expo that I mentioned earlier, the website is redpillexpo.org in beautiful Hartford. I don't want to oversell Hartford. In building-filled Hartford, Connecticut. But this event is obviously not about Hartford sightseeing. Go to the website, look at the list of presenters, and I hope to see you there. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care.
In the future, no one will fight with anyone else. In the future, there will be an atomic war. In the future, water will be expensive. In the future, all material items will be free. In the future, everyone's house will be like a little fortress. In the future, everyone's house will be a total entertainment center.
Hi, Pam. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? It's good to be here.
I'm doing well. I wanted to start at the beginning. People in my audience are always very interested when I have guests who do some form of homeschooling, home education, why they started. You were telling me you took your children out of public school almost 20 years ago. I was wondering what you saw that made you decide to pursue home education. And a follow-up question would be, what did that look like when you first started doing it?
Well, homeschooling was my last option. Never tell God never, because he'll laugh about that. I had heard of home education from a friend and thought she was out of her mind because it sounded so intimidating. I am the daughter of two public school teachers. My children were attending public school. And what was starting to bother me was that as my oldest entered fifth grade, I saw an increasing push from the school, basically for parents to back off. They were very happy to have my assistance in the elementary school level. If I wanted to come in and teach a special class, or if I wanted to come in and watch the kids for a lunch hour, that was always very welcome. But it was like a programmed response or a programmed message that once the children entered fifth grade, they didn't want us there. We were told by the schools, the children really didn't want us there. They were at that age where it embarrassed them, etc. I did visit my son's class 1 year. I did not have the same activity level, but that was concerning. And my youngest child was about to enter kindergarten. And I was involved in the PTA and going to PTA meetings and learned about the new no tolerance policy as well.
Zero tolerance.
Zero tolerance.
As we called it in New Hampshire, yes.
Zero tolerance. And when I questioned about that, I couldn't believe it. I laughed like I'm laughing now. And said, so, you know, I have two boys. If you say that they can't pick up a stick and pretend it's a gun, they're going to use their finger. And you are describing something. Are you saying there are all the kindergartners are going to be, you know, confined to the classroom on lockdown because somebody pointed their finger?
Right.
And I got a disturbing silence in response to that, and a little smile like, well, this is what we're told is going to be happening. I didn't think at the time to ask who was telling them that, or where that direction was coming from. It was the principal who was smiling at me that way and giving me that information, but that also made me very uncomfortable. So seeing that as my oldest was about to enter seventh grade, I was becoming more and more dissatisfied with the public school, the pushback that I was getting on parental involvement, and just certain classes and things like that. For instance, my daughter's classroom learning to do like a dance and thanking Mother Earth. As a Christian, I told my child, the earth is not our mother. We can be respectful and good stewards, but it also was interesting that the school they were attending was involved in learning about different countries. So I love history. And when I grew up, I was learning history from the center out. So first you learned about your community, and then you learned about your state, and then you learned about your country, and then you know, peripherally, you were learning about other countries. That was usually more in-depth the older you got. You weren't introducing that kind of sequence at the lower grades. And when I asked when they were going to, you know, why is there this in-depth study of this particular country? When are they going to learn about American history? I didn't get a satisfactory answer. Now, looking back on it, that global focus makes sense because I know where it's coming from. So all of those pieces put together made me very concerned when my son was about to enter seventh grade, and I attended a kind of a welcome, an open house kind of thing, where they took the best and the brightest students from that grade level and had them on a panel together with school administrators who were sitting in the auditorium while the parents came and listened to how wonderful the school was and how it worked.
Right.
And the question that I asked was, you've outlined that there's 32 different clubs my child could join. Will I have an opportunity to discuss my child's choices with him before he makes those choices? Because they did the same thing at the fifth grade level. And I was kind of like given the bill for, these are the tools or whatever your child is going to need to participate in this club that you didn't know he was engaged in.
Oh, I mean, 20 years ago, that's the genesis of this. I mean, today, clubs are even named misleading things and run by activist teachers. This is something that we see popping up again and again, where parents might think their child is in a club doing something completely different.
And I had had conversations with other parents whose children were in higher level grades. So that also added to my concerns. And I wanted to hear what they would have to say. And I feel badly for the poor young junior high school student who tried to answer my question, who said, well, it, you know, she looked around at the rest of the panel like, what is she saying? Well, you'll know because you'll have to sign permission slips, like if they go someplace. Okay, let me restate the question. No, my question is, will I have an opportunity to have input into my son's decision about club membership so that I know what's involved before he makes those choices?
Before permission slips start coming home.
Before permission slips are coming out. That was the point where the social worker in the school put her hand up in front of the poor student who was trying to answer the question and was totally lost and said, I'll handle this. And said, you know, they're all getting older and we all, it's always hard to let go, but this is a time when it's time to let go a little bit and let them make their choices. Let them make their choices or your choices.
Let go and let school.
Oh, don't say that when I'm drinking my tea.
They are masking this as the promotion of independence, which I think is a great thing. But if it's just the transfer to another form of, I don't want to call what, I mean, transferring from parental involvement and guidance to indoctrination, that's a huge problem. And that's what's being covered, it sounds.
Yes. Yes. And that's what it sounded like to me.
Right.
That was all I needed to hear. I knew some people in my church who were homeschooling. And so I talked to them about the possibility and I was very worried. And at the time I thought, okay, I'm just going to dip my toe in the water here. Because it's the idea of doing this, especially starting with seventh grade curriculum, is intimidating. And ironically, I was even more frightened of trying to teach my youngest how to read. That was a total unknown. But I sat down and talked to these friends for quite a while. I mentioned to one of them that I was thinking of homeschooling only the seventh grader at first, because the school was doing okay at the, you know, it was less offensive, at the elementary level, and I could get my feet wet that way. She reminded me, she said, you know, as good of a job as you think they're doing academically, they're just as effective at indoctrinating.
Right.
That was all I needed to hear on that one. Homeschool all of them.
We're talking about a time period here where No Child Left Behind, which was just the basically the latest development in a long line of these plans to standardize and nationalize a curriculum, was coming into place in America's public schools.
I was totally unaware of it at the time. Goals 2000 came out.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Well, some people have traced this back to the 60s. Some people have traced this back to the 30s. I think there's a lineage that goes all the way back to the implementation of national public public schools in the United States. But yeah, you definitely see things ramping up in the 90s. I think Goals 2000 was 1994. Obviously, No Child Left Behind was the beginning of the Bush administration, and Common Core was the beginning of the Obama administration. And I've heard it described as boosters send rockets into orbit, and then all of these things are just about maintaining the orbit, right? Just making them, like, nice how would we ever live without Common Core? You know, like when Common Core was first proposed, just like No Child Left Behind, just like Goals 2000, it's like, this is an outrage. There can't be this much control and monitoring over the public schools. But after it's been there a generation, people are going to say, how could we live without it? So you're at the beginning of this process, even though you're kind of unaware that things are changing with No Child Left Behind, or things are ramping up, I think is a more appropriate way to say it. It's being sold to you as like, well, you have a child who is getting to that age where children seek more independence. But what's actually happening is school is changing for, not that it was great in the 90s, but now it's changing for all children, even the younger children. It seems like that was part of your discovery when you made this decision.
Yes, absolutely.
So you were working as an attorney, and you left the practice of law to pursue home education with your children. That's correct?
Actually, I left the practice of law after I had my first child. So I had not been practicing law since he was born, essentially. Although I've maintained my interest in what was happening legally and politically, just watching the news and that kind of thing. But I wasn't as informed as I became later on as my children got older and I had free time.
So as your children got older, you returned to at least participation in a lot of these legal activities around educational freedom in your state of Connecticut. You know, I spent some time in Connecticut in 2013. I stayed with a couple of friends for a summer. The lack of freedom and the abundance of regulation is quite palpable in the state of Connecticut in many ways. You know, like, things are really expensive, the cost of living.
Yes.
But one thing that's interesting, and I was actually looking at a study that Cato puts out. I think Cato puts it out yearly about freedom in the 50 states, it's called. And it goes through a really broad range of categories for each state. Mm-hmm. Connecticut usually ranks in the bottom 10 in most categories.
Oh, I've got to go and look at that. I look at Cato for other purposes, but I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, so it's called freedominthe50states.org, and then you can just go state by state. I think you can compare one state to another. That being said, there is actually a fair amount of educational freedom, or at least even if it's not educational freedom, because the public schools in Connecticut are subject to the same national laws and regulations, but there has been at least throughout this century so far, a pretty hands-off approach when it comes to home educators, homeschoolers, Christian or otherwise, unschoolers. And we have seen, really, in this most recent decade, some attempts to clamp down on that. And those are efforts that you have been involved in. So I wanted to just get the highlights of your experience doing that. How you got involved with that. You said as your children got older and you had more time, you shifted some attention into looking at some of the policy developments. Why did you decide to get involved and how did you get involved?
Well, you know, that was kind of one of those things of, as I left the practice of law and my mother said, oh, all that schooling, aren't you going to like ever go to practice again?
Yeah.
And I thought, well, if I return to practice, I would want to be involved in preserving educational freedom, specifically for homeschoolers. And this was an opportunity for me to get reconnected with that. Yeah. And I contacted Teach. I had been a member for years, and I contacted Teach. I knew that they were having changes in their board, changes in their personnel, and said, do you have someone who's currently monitoring your legislation? I would like to do that. Mm-hmm. And so that was just the right timing. They said, we'd love to have you do that. And started getting involved that way. And things were very busy from the beginning. The Sandy Hook Commission report came out, and Teach, along with some other education advocacy and parental advocacy organizations, joined together to form the Parental Rights Coalition to address the commission's report. At the same time that Common Core came out, the data collection system came out. So in a short time, I was also writing about the problems with Common Core for homeschoolers so they understood what was wrong with that curriculum. Mm-hmm. And also with the data collection. And then the following year, the coalition got involved in advocating for the student data privacy bill, which would protect student privacy rights to their data. Teach decided to participate in that because a lot of homeschool students will start to do, whether you want to call it dual credit enrollment or early enrollment in colleges, community colleges. My own children did that. So once you touch the public schools, once you go back to that format, then your data starts to be collected. In fact, my oldest child, my oldest one who's in community college, my daughter, who's my middle child, she was the first one to do a community college class, and she did an online class. In order to qualify to do an online class, you had to take an online exam. Here's that deceptive title. Okay. Mm-hmm. The exam is billed as something that's going to determine whether or not you can handle the technology of an online class. You know how to use the computer. Mm-hmm. I didn't sit and watch the entire exam that they were taking with them. I wasn't sitting next to her seeing all of the exam questions. Wish I'd known then, because I would have had her taking screenshots.
What year was this? I'm
trying to think of when she graduated, maybe somewhere around 2012, 2013.
Okay.
Somewhere in there. Let's see.
All right.
4 years, 2 years, 2013. So maybe between 2011 and 2013, I'd say.
Okay.
Because it was in her last years of high school. So I wasn't sitting next to her watching her take this exam. That's about that growing independence, right? This
right.
is her work. So at the end of the exam, she said, "Oh, Mom, this tells me that I'm strong in this area, but that I could improve in this other area." And I can't even remember what they were. But as soon as she said this, this had nothing to do with knowing how to run a computer. This was about personality. This was a psychology assessment.
Attitudinal outcomes, right? This is the big thing.
Even as I repeat the story, my mouth is opening. It just blew my mind.
Right.
Yeah. So that showed me that when we got involved as part of the coalition in the student data privacy bill, that homeschoolers would be affected. Anyone who went back into the college setting or touched the public schools was going to have their data collected as well. All sorts
right.
of data. Attitudinal, what did you call it? Attitudinal what?
I picked up that phrase from outcomes-based education. Assessments aren't being done for the sake of measuring academic performance, but for testing attitudes and values.
Yes.
And children are basically remediated until the proper, air quotes, attitudes and values have been inculcated, and that can be assessed. You know, you think about a word like test, that sounds like it has something to do with knowledge. Assessment is more of mm-hmm. a nebulous word that could incorporate more things, like revising a child's attitudes and values from the attitudes and values they got maybe someplace at home, right?
Yep. That's clearly what it was about.
Right. So that's definitely a feature of outcomes-based education. The other thread that's kind of run through a couple points in our conversation so far, you talked about a lot of the revelations coming out of the Sandy Hook Commission report. And this was a place where you wanted to be, you were involved, and you probably also recognized more of a need to be involved. We talked about zero tolerance earlier in the conversation. Now, zero tolerance was ramping up when I was in school in the 1990s. So it wasn't new at the time you were pulling your children out of school, but what had just happened was Columbine. And now it was basically a mandate in the result of this tragedy to have these zero tolerance policies about violence or anything that could be seen as a precursor to violence, basically go into this school. I don't want to say school to prison pipeline might be a little too harsh, but definitely school to criminal justice system pipeline, school to data collection pipeline, was an outgrowth of zero tolerance. So in 2012, we have Sandy Hook. And again, there's a government overreach in response to a tragedy. This is a way to pry into not just the lives of children in the school, but as you mentioned, beyond the school. So what was it? I know this was quite some time ago, but what was it in the Sandy Hook Commission report that was really alarming to home educating parents and really parental advocates in the state of Connecticut?
Well, the thing that alarmed us was that they were calling for homeschool regulation based upon their statement that Adam Lanza was a homeschooled student.
Right.
And so we sent emails to the commission and to our legislators saying Adam Lanza was not homeschooled. He was never homeschooled. He was a homebound student for a period of time, but a homebound student is under the authority of the public school system. Right. He fell through the gaps in a public school system that didn't know how to deal with him. And it's very expensive to send out a tutor. It's questionable how much tutoring he received at home. And the educational records have been finally, after all these years, released to, I believe it's the Hartford Courant, but not to the public. Until the Hartford Courant reviews them and they get their scoop, I guess. I'm not quite sure how that works.
Right.
We still don't have access to them. And my understanding is that the psychologist who treated Adam Lanza, who has fled the country because of charges that he had inappropriate sexual relationships with his with at least one of his patients, but has returned, that he destroyed the medical records of Adam Lanza.
Well, when this commission was going on and this investigation was happening, there were lots of questions about those medical records. And at that time, they were not forthcoming. And, you know, what's interesting is, well, there's this focus on Adam Lanza being schooled outside of a school building from the best I can tell, 1 year for behavioral issues when he was in eighth grade. There is a complete absence of information about the work done with him at something called the Yale Child Study Center.
Yes.
Right? Now, these people are called to testify in front of the commission to make recommendations about what policy should be in the aftermath of Sandy Hook, right? The Yale Child Study Center testifies in front of this commission. A Yale psychiatrist testifies in front of this commission. But what's also absent is, in addition to Adam Lanza's educational history, is Adam Lanza's pharmaceutical intervention history, which I think still might be questionable. I know that his mother, Nancy, was reported by the psychiatrist working with Adam as disobedient or non-compliant because she was raising questions about some of his reactions to drugs like Celexa and Lexapro, these really like adverse reactions that he was having. And,
yes.
And, you know, this is public now. But there was a lot of question about this back when the commission was going on. And of course, that's left out.
It's public, but it's not often discussed.
Right, that's it. Yeah.
I see a lot of news articles, media articles, repeating the same thing, that it was Nancy Lanza who was so uncooperative. I think there was one article that came out of New York, not surprising that it wasn't a Connecticut media outlet, that spoke about the fact that Nancy Lanza called and said, these are the symptoms he's having. They all turned out to be side effects of the medication that he had been taking, and she wanted to take him off that medication, understandably.
And it's not hard to believe that when a person reaches 20 years old, which was the age Adam Lanza was when that incident happened, they would be making their own decisions, even if they were prescribed medication, about whether or not to take it, especially considering adverse reactions they might be having to it. But I know there are still some gray areas about what he was taking when and why. And obviously there's going to be questions forever about was he taking the drugs properly. I don't know if he was prescribed medication at the time of the Sandy Hook shooting. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing here, even though there's all of those sort of blank spots in the commission report about that, is that you're right. That kind of intervention, like a state intervention into a child's mind, is not on the table for discussion when deliberating what to do about something like this, which in itself is very telling, very alarming.
Yes, it is. And there were members of the commission, I'm sorry, I can't recall their names, but I think there were some members of the commission who had ties to Yale.
Well, there was one, I actually pulled up an article about it. Dr. Ezra Griffin was a psychiatrist at the university who was chosen by the governor to participate on the commission, right? Yeah. Tasked with making recommendations about mental health care in the state. Furthermore, the Yale Child Study Center testified before the advisory commission.
Yeah.
And, you know, the article is pointing out that this might be a little bit of a conflict of interest, considering that things were certainly, there's lots of evidence that things were mismanaged by that latter organization, the Yale Child Study Center, when it came to Lanza's treatment.
Yep.
So the recommendations based on Adam Lanza is homeschooled claim are what kind of intervention into homeschool situations in the state of Connecticut?
You know, I honestly, without going back and reviewing some of the files, I don't recall. I just remember that we were just shocked that they were suggesting any kind of regulation dealing with homeschoolers when there was no connection between homeschooling and Adam Lanza.
Right.
Having recently heard the history of Teach back in the late 90s and when it was formed, mid 90s, 95, 94, et cetera, that there were proposals to have high regulation even then. It was within what was called the SHED guidelines, the state home education guidelines, that would have, oh, these are back from 1982. I just pulled my booklet here from this recent talk. Mm-hmm. Would have had the Board of Education determine if instruction is equivalent, and a child would have to remain in public school until authorized to leave to homeschool. Mm-hmm. It would have required meeting with the superintendents and periodic testing. So those are the kinds of regulations, very high regulations, similar to New York's and other high regulation states that they would really like to see. The thing that does not get repeated in media reports, specifically, for instance, in this year when we testified on a bill that would have required in-person registration for homeschoolers, mm-hmm. that was buried in the governor's budget bill. Although we have talked to reporters and although the statute is there for anyone to see, most people are looking at media articles, and the media in Connecticut never talks about the first sentence in 10.184 of the statutes. It's that sentence that dates back to 1650 that makes homeschooling the default mode of instruction in Connecticut, because that was a time before public education.
Right.
The first sentence that nobody ever hears is that all parents and those who have the care of children shall bring them up in some lawful and honest employment and instruct them or cause them to be instructed in reading, writing, spelling, English, grammar, geography, arithmetic, and United States history and in citizenship, including a study of the town, state, and federal governments. Period. That's unique in the country. And the New England states are more likely to have that kind of structure for their education because they started early and it was common for parents to instruct their own children. But in discussing this, there was a recent article, despite the fact that I discussed it with the reporter, that part of the statute never got into print. That the ultimate responsibility for education of children begins with the parents. It resides with the parents to educate mm-hmm. their children, whether they do it themselves or whether they hire others to do so or whether they send them to the public schools.
And even when they go to the public schools, it's not the complete outsourcing of that responsibility, which it seems like in these meetings that you described earlier in our conversation, that's what you were being encouraged to do as a parent. Like, back off.
Step back. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's our turn now. Yeah. that's right. And the accusation has been made about, oh, you don't own your children. Your children are autonomous individuals. Yes, they are. But our laws in our country have recognized since our inception, children are not equipped to make autonomous decisions until they reach a certain age. That's why companies who make money don't enter into contracts with children.
Right.
Children don't have the authority to enter into contracts. So when they talk about autonomy, what they really are talking about, it seems to me, is they want to shift instruction and training to the state, because that's what's happening with children before they reach a certain age. You're training the children, and it's the parents who step in and exercise rights for the children and guide them. The family is the center of our culture. The family is what works, and things work themselves out from there, not the other way around. Top-down instruction only works for the top.
Well said. And, you know, it seems like the family and the community is seen as more of a threat, more of an obstacle, more of a competitor to all of these top-down efforts that have really accelerated through the time, you know, I was in public school, the 80s and the 90s. I guess that would coincide a little bit with the time your children were in public school. And obviously what's happened in the last two decades has been that on steroids, even though these efforts, you can trace them to the beginning of the Department of Education, to the progressive reform movements at the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, even the very setup of the system itself, when it was first brought here from, you know, a pretty oppressive kingdom in Central Europe, in the middle of the 1800s, it has that kind of top-down idea of we will decide, you know, they have lots of euphemisms for it in the 21st century, like school to work or workforce development training. But back then they were like, look, we're going to take some people and prepare them to be, you know, the nobility. We're going to take some people and prepare them to be the managers. And we're going to take everybody else and prepare them to be managed. You know, and that was their school system, and that was brought here by Horace Mann. That's the foundation of this thing 170 years ago in this country. If you don't remove that foundation, right, that it's the state's responsibility, it's the state's purview, obviously all those problems are just going to remain, and I would say accelerated, and I would say that they have since that time.
No, they've continued to accelerate, and you can track it to the disintegration of the family. As you pull apart the family, pull apart the supports on a myriad of fronts, whether it's education or medicine or whatever, the home, all of the places that we see the state trying to intrude and take over that decision-making process, it's failing abysmally in the push, not just for education, but for more of that control for the mental and behavioral health bills that are coming out and have since I started working with Teach back in 2013. There was a legislator back in 2013. There was a bill initially that called for might have been a resolution called for the endorsement of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. And then later on, the then senator sponsored a bill that would have adopted as state guiding policy the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. And that document is also very geared towards childhood autonomy. The false idea of childhood autonomy. We can see it in the mental and behavioral health bills. We can see it in the medical decisions. Connecticut is a state, for instance, that requires parental consent for a teenager to have their ears pierced but permits abortion without parental consent or notification. We have people traveling across the border from Rhode Island to get abortions for minors. And that kind of behavior gives an open door for human trafficking. So when you keep on cutting the family out, the state does a very poor job in its place.
Indeed, I would think that some international form of government would do an even poorer job. And that's been the trend, right? A few minutes ago,
yes,
I talked about the foundation. So in the beginning, 170 years ago, to be most accurate, when the Prussian system came to America, the foundation was that education is the responsibility of the state. And I mean these specific states. The first place it came is Massachusetts. Other states in the nation at that time looked at what was happening, what the proposal was. They said, this is a gold mine. This is, I mean, obedience, conformity, having people learn their place in society. How do we get started? And it spread like wildfire around the country at that time. Well, by the latter half of the 20th century, that control was federal. And by the turn of the century, there's very, very strong and persuasive arguments that that control was international. And, you know, when you talk about your interventions in the state of Connecticut to prevent the antagonists to homeschooling from reaching in and controlling more, but also extracting information from homeschool students and homeschool families, what is also there is a conduit to get state, federal, and now international standards into homeschooling, I think, which is obviously something that people would want to guard against. So that's actually, I think, a fair transition to talking about the international impact on the schools. Some people have traced at least back to the 1960s, I know, in places like Minnesota, but there were lots of warnings about this through the 90s with Goals 2000 and with the implementation of No Child Left Behind. So this is actually going to be a big focus in your presentation that you're going to be giving at Red Pill. Can we just talk a little bit, I guess, about the dangers of specifically the UN's impact on the public schools in the United States?
It goes back to UN Agenda 2030 and the Sustainable Development Goals. Doesn't that sound lovely?
It's how education could you not want for a sustainable future.
but Sustainable Development Goal, I think it's 4.7, and I don't have the language in front of me. I'm trying to see if I can find it. It addresses education, and it requires that by 2030, children, that they will not only kind of agree with sustainable development, but will also promote it themselves. So they're talking about training up children to become community activists and to become agents of the government. That doesn't sound like autonomy, does it? You're an agent of the government promoting the government's agenda, then you've lost your autonomy and you've lost your liberty and you've lost your choices. And when you were talking about the international scene, I'm thinking, I have family that lives in Europe. Their children are pursuing college now, but in conversations, I've heard them express their frustration with the European system of college because they have to pass a certain test. And if they can't pass a certain test at a certain level, then their choices on what they want to pursue are much more limited. Someone might say, well, gosh, that sounds really efficient. You know, you don't want, you know, Johnny to go off thinking that he can be a brain surgeon if he really doesn't have it in him. Mm-hmm. But you know what, when you're 13 or 14 or 15, Johnny's dealing with so much. You don't know whether or not Johnny might develop an interest and some talents and use his perseverance to decide that he wants to buckle down and do that brain surgeon kind of study. It should be up to Johnny. That's the kind of autonomy we're talking about. That's the classical educational model that we've had in the United States since our beginning until Dewey and those came over in the 1850s with the Prussian model for American public education. It's classical education that makes people critical thinkers. It's classical education that gives people choices that the UN agenda would abolish.
So it's a well-rounded liberal arts education and the pursuit of knowledge and some successes and some failures, you know, some trial and error inside those lessons that actually helps a young person find direction in life. So sure, there's probably some desirable middle ground between the 8-year-old who says, you know, I want to be an astronaut prince and having the European Union pick a career for you, right? Those are like two super extremes. And the balance is the liberal arts education. A person learns to think critically. They're emerged in the world. They get to experience success and failure. And from there, they cut their own path. They understand what's realistic and what isn't realistic as they grow. But yeah, you're right. I mean, England, and this was nothing new in England. I mean, I know this test goes back to the 60s at least. It was like a name and a number. I think it was a test that kids took at the beginning of high school that would basically point them towards certain vocations.
Yes.
It's very socialist.
And, you know, when we talk about education, you and I have talked a little bit about the way that words are twisted now. You and I, because we've been studying this, can recognize some of the buzzwords. Right. That really will flag the involvement of the UN agenda, the globalist mindset, et cetera. But when we talk about education, the global agenda doesn't limit educational goals to children. In fact, if you look at the Sustainable Development Goal 4.7, it doesn't talk about children. It talks about learners. Mm-hmm. And then we will see it implemented for all citizens. So you'll hear phrases like lifelong learning. You'll see the digital badges that are already being offered online in America. You'll see implementation of something similar to China's social credit system.
Right.
Facebook already has its trust score, even though you can't see it yet.
Do you know who coined the term lifelong learning?
Tell me.
Vladimir Lenin.
Yes. If you use the term correctly, it is a noble goal. We all want to think that we are still capable of learning, and we are. But what are we free to learn, really? And that's the difference between home education versus indoctrination by the government.
Right. Global citizenship is another one of these seemingly innocuous, now even kind of cliche terms that comes out of that same UNESCO document, 2003, Education for a Sustainable Future. And then this trickles down into an even more fluffy kind of marketing language as it's distributed into the schools. But yeah, I mean, once you get a sense of what this is, there's this organization called EdWatch did a bunch of great work on this, I think, within the last 20 years. Michael Chapman.
Yes.
Went through how this actually trickles down to the textbook levels, where he was saying, okay, here's what elementary school kids are learning about the Bill of Rights, where in the spirit of sustainable development, a sustainable future, global citizenship, instead of learning about what the Bill of Rights are, the debate around them, what they mean in terms of negative rights, like here are things the government can't do to you, they are being given this exercise in a book where the teacher's manual says, have them make a bill of rights for animals.
You know, when you start talking about animal bills of rights, what's really happening? You're equating animals with humans. And if humans are just animals, then you can do all sorts of things to them. Tell them what to think. You can tell them what medications to take. I won't go too much further than that, but it's just a question to consider.
But if humans are animals, they also need a fair amount of husbandry.
Isn't it sad that the term that we think of associated with a family, a husband, is used in such a twisted way? But yes, you're right.
So you see things like the Declaration of Independence downplayed, and then like the follow-ups like the Bill of Rights, which are about negative rights, being swapped out for the care of human beings through things like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which are all about positive rights. You know, the government will do these things for you. But people also learn, instead of even the concept of negative rights, like what's in the Bill of Rights, that concept is lost. Rights are things that the government grants to the human animal.
That's right. As opposed to
what
our country was founded on, natural God-given mm-hmm. rights that are inalienable. We came into this world with them. They were not granted by the government, and they cannot be taken away.
Well said. We got a lot done in an hour of conversation there.
We did.
Awesome. And you're going to be the very first speaker at the expo, correct?
Yes. I always step into these things that are a little bit intimidating.
Indeed. Yeah. If people want to learn more about the organization that you do work with, and this Teach is national, right? There's a chapter in each state.
Teach is unique to Connecticut. Teach, that's why it's Teach CT, the Education Association of Christian Homeschoolers of Connecticut. We do work with HSLDA, which is a national organization. We are not formally affiliated with them, but we do work with them, speak to them, attend their conference, etc. And that's the Homeschool Legal Defense Association.
Okay, so that's a national organization. I want to thank you for a very informative conversation, and of course also for the work you do trying to maintain educational freedom in what is not one of America's freest states. I know that's a lot of work, so I'm sure the people who do home education in Connecticut are greatly appreciative as well. Thank you so much, Pam, for coming on the show. I enjoyed the chat.
Thanks, Brett. It was great to talk to you, get to know a little bit more about you, and to hear some great analogies and phrases that, well, try to tuck away for future use.
Please do. I'd be honored if you would.
Yes.
In the future, political and other decisions will be based completely on opinion polls. In the future, there will be a machine which will produce a religious experience in the user. In the future, there will be groups of wild people living in the wilderness. In the future, there will only be paper money, which will be personalized. In the future, there will be a classless society. So much going on that no one will be able to keep track of it.